A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Almost exactly 1 year ago, Christopher Krebs was working as the head of the federal government's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. He was, quote, the administration's most senior cybersecurity official responsible for security in the presidential election. As such, he had created a CISA website to debunk election-related disinformation, much of which was coming from the head of the administration itself, then-President Donald Trump, who had lost his bid for re-election and was issuing wild falsehoods about fraudulent votes. Krebs wasn't having it. On November 17th, 2020, Krebs tweeted, quote, 59 election security experts all agree. In every case of which we are aware, these claims of fraud either have been unsubstantiated or are technically incoherent, end quote. Hours later, on that same day, November 17th, Trump fired Krebs. In a tweet filled with conspiracy theories, Trump said, quote, there were massive improprieties and fraud, including dead people voting, poll watchers not being allowed into polling locations, glitches in the voting machines which changed votes from Trump to Biden, late voting, and many more. Therefore, effective immediately, Chris Krebs has been terminated as director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. End quote. That was November 17th, 2020. Almost exactly 1 year later, just last month, Krebs and a special commission from the Aspen Institute have put out a report saying that although election officials have spent roughly $1 billion making elections more secure against hacking, the greatest threat to the nation's electoral system remains the lies, misinformation, and conspiracy theories that technology helps spread. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And those conspiracy theories are still being trumpeted by former President Donald Trump. Here he is in Iowa in October of this year.
And you can't say I didn't warn you, but I also can't say you didn't get out because you got out and voted like no sitting president has ever received votes before. The election was rigged.
The election was not rigged. But that didn't stop Trump from lying to the Iowa crowd about how Wisconsin voted in 2020.
In the state of Wisconsin, and actually, we won by a lot.
Trump did not win in Wisconsin. He lost the state to Joe Biden by roughly 21,000 votes. Wisconsin has also been through multiple recounts and lawsuits, and a nonpartisan audit reported in October, just a couple of months ago, that there was no widespread fraud, the state's elections are safe and secure. Well, Chris Krebs joins us now from Washington. He's a partner in the Krebs Stamos Group, and he is co-chair, as I mentioned, of the Commission on Information Disorder from the Aspen Institute. Christopher Krebs, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
Former President Trump is still saying this stuff. That was just, a little over a month ago, the tape we played in Iowa. So what difference can any changes to technology make when the font of disinformation regarding elections is still spewing forth all of these conspiracy theories?
It's even more recent than that. Earlier this week, I believe it was over the weekend or maybe late last week, the former president issued a statement, which is what he's unfortunately well, or fortunately, constrained to his issuing these from his desk type statements. But he challenged any takers to a debate on the credibility of the 2020 election. Now, despite having hundreds of takers, he then claimed that no one took him up on his offer, and so he rescinded his offer for a debate. But look, the point here, more than anything, is there are no consequences effectively for the former president to spew these lies. In fact, the incentive structures work the other way. He can fundraise. He can have these rallies and continue to amplify the lies and activate his base. He's got hundreds of millions of dollars in a political action committee war chest. So it actually works to his incentive or to his interest to continue driving these lies. So to your broader question here is, what is the role of technology? And I think there is a significant obligation across the social media platforms to do a better job of being transparent in how certain actors, certainly the so to speak super spreaders of disinfo, to limit the reach or at least provide insight to researchers and journalists on how their platforms are being abused at the expense of democracy.
Mm. Now, I promise we will get into some detail about the report that you mm-hmm. co-chaired, this Commission on Information Disorder from the Aspen Institute, especially the recommendations. So we will do that. But prior to that, how concerned are you that this information disorder, these lies and conspiracy theories that then get massively amplified through technology and media, that in 2022, in the midterms of next year, could that spill over into actual physical disorder?
It's already happened, right? January 6th was a physical manifestation of disinformation around the 2020 election. And in fact, we essentially at CISA, we predicted this. In 2019, we released an awareness campaign called the War on Pineapple, and the idea here was to educate the American people on how disinformation operations work. And it's effectively a five-step process, but first you start with identifying the issue you want to drive at, and here it was election disinfo. The second was you start putting accounts into place and getting your amplifiers, and that happened through some of the president's acolytes, aides, even his own family. And the third is you start hitting that on the platforms, Facebook, Twitter, elsewhere. Fourth is you take it mainstream. And we saw that on Fox News. We saw that on Newsmax, OAN, Bannon's War Room, all these fringe networks. And then fifth is you take it mainstream. You take it to the real world. And that's what January 6th was. It was the activation of the amplification that had been taking place for almost, nine months at that point. So I fully expect to see that happen again. And I think we're starting to see some of the seeds of that happen today with the wake or the constant goalpost moving of you mentioned the Arizona, the fraud audit or, you know, the fake audit that took place out there. You're starting to see some of these the pushers, the amplifiers start to talk about citizen canvases where they want volunteers to start going out and knocking on doors throughout the various states and start talking to people about, did you vote? Who'd you vote for? And that's where you're going to start seeing that friction again in the real world that's going to lead to ultimately to political violence, as I see it. 22 at a minimum, but certainly 24.
Well, Chris Krebs, stand by here for a moment. Jack Beattie is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Mr. Krebs.
Respond, Jack, with your thoughts on what Chris Krebs says, because while I do respect the effort that's gone into the Commission's report on information disorder, given the urgency of the very near future that he just laid out, it does seem that almost like talking about how we have a whole of society fix for the problem of disinformation feels a little bit like whistling in the wind almost.
Or the hurricane, yes.
The hurricane, yeah.
You know, Mr. Krebs, I was just looking at, up this, and right after you made your truthful statement about the election and were fired, Joe DeGeneva, who's a Trump legal hack, said you should, quote, be drawn and quartered, taken out at dawn and shot. That threat was emblematic of a wave of threats to other election officials across the country. Reuters in September documented over 800 of these to election officials everywhere. That's the sort of raw thuggist element of the Trump fiction, where it's really fecund with evil consequences. The second tier of it, of course, are the Trump endorsements, again, on the recruiting purveyors of the big lie to be candidates for secretaries of state in the states, people who handle the election. He's already endorsed three in Arizona, Michigan, and Georgia. Probably Nevada, Minnesota, and Ohio are coming up. There are 26 states that'll have Secretary of State elections in 2022, setting up the possibility that the people who'll be running the 2024 elections will be essentially, you know, creatures of the Trumpist lie on handling the ballot in 2024. And then the third tier, of course, are the laws in, 19 states that suppress the vote in the name of the lie, and the most pernicious of which is the Georgia Bill 202 that allows state officials, votaries of the lie, to take over local election boards. Mr. Krebs, are we heading toward a situation where this great lie is ready to essentially become the reality in 2024 and to upend our democratic institutions?
It's worse than that, unfortunately. You actually have candidates for federal office for the state Senate. You've got Josh Mandel in Ohio who's campaigning on the fact that he's the first candidate for statewide office that believes that the election was stolen from the former president. So you're seeing this in the House. I mean, it's 1,000 times worse. So, yeah, this is the reality. It's not just about the disinfo. It's the putting in place the people that can pull the levers to maybe change the decisions and not push back. You know, we may not have a Brad Raffensperger in Georgia. Whether he likes politics or not, the guy did what was right. Jody Heiss might not do the same thing in 24 if he wins.
Well, Christopher Krebs and Jack Beatty, stand by. We're going to be talking much more about what the greatest threat to not only America's electoral system, but our collective faith in it is. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today Christopher Krebs joins us. He's a partner at the Krebs Stamos Group. You probably know him from his work as former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at the Department of Homeland Security. He held that post from November 2018 to November 2020. He's more recently co-chair of a commission from the Aspen Institute, the Commission on Information disorder, and they put out a comprehensive report about a long-term plan on how to fight the sort of vile hydra of conspiracy theories and disinformation and its impact across American life. And Chris Krebs, Jack Beattie also joins us, by the way, On Point news analyst. Jack, I will never forget you. But Chris Krebs, in the commission's report, it says pretty clearly right at the top that, quote, the biggest lie of all, which this crisis thrives on and which the beneficiaries of mis- and disinformation feed on, is that the crisis itself is uncontainable. But we just spent the last segment talking about how you pretty much you foresee political violence in 2022, 2024, a large chunk of the electorate primed to not believe the results of the election, perhaps even people being formally put into place to overturn election results. So that sounds like it does sound like an uncontainable crisis. So push back on that. Why do you think that's a lie, that it's uncontainable?
Well, of course, threats against democracy are just one of the harms that is being pushed in the broader information disorder space. And, you know, as I was leaving government last year, thinking about the things that, you know, I had felt I had left undone that I wanted to put more effort into, stepping back from the tactical edge of countering disinformation, which I'd been doing over the last several years with elections, and even COVID disinfo, related disinfo, I wanted to kind of work back up the stack and think more structurally. What are the systemic reasons for where we are today? And look, as I've discovered, and I think is fairly intuitive to most everyone, is that disinfo is just a natural power play, right? It's used by those that want to seek power, influence, or money. And the horrible joke I've made in the past is that really disinformation, whether it's fake news, propaganda, whatever you want to call it, is probably one of the world's oldest professions, if not maybe the third oldest profession, where intelligence collection is the second. And those things are paired. And we know what the first is, so I'm not going to talk about that today. But look, I mean, this is what people in power or that want to gain influence or grift, this is what they use. So it's happening in the in the COVID space right now. It's happening in broader technology spaces. It's happening and has happened since the dawn of America with disadvantaged communities. Mm-hmm. So it is just a tool that those in power use. So are there things we can do to manage this risk, manage this threat? We're not going to eradicate it, but we can manage it and limit the harms, increase transparency, and get back to building trust in institutions. And frankly, that's where we are right now. It's erosion of trust in institutions.
But you say, though, in the commission's report that proactive leadership rising from within every sector and institution in our society is the only way out of this crisis. You're asking the very people who you just said benefit and most joyfully exploit misinformation to be the leaders to get us out of it. I mean, I don't. How's that?
Not everybody's a sociopath. All right. I mean, not everyone that works in government's a sociopath.
There are enough people who malevolently spread disinformation and misinformation in very influential positions in this in the society that I think. How are you going to get enough other leaders to overcome the influence of those who do exploit misinformation or who cause chaos, I should say, in the information space? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is no silver bullet, of course, or there's no magic wand we can wave, but it's through engagement. It's through constant work. Again, this is not easy. It's going to take others in industry, in the media community, to call out Fox News and Tucker Carlson, right? We have to continue pushing that. We have to have business leaders who actually have a higher degree of trust based on public polling than political leaders. We need business leaders to step up and say, you know what? We're not going to advertise on these programs like Laura Logan that's comparing Fauci to Dr. Joseph Mengele. I mean, it beggars belief that we're still in the space. But that's where it is. So we need more leadership in the business community. We need more leadership in the government space to actually say, look, we understand this is a problem. It's not just an intelligence community thing. It's a broader societal issue. So what is our plan? How are we going to do it? all within the constraints, or rather the construct, of the First Amendment and protected speech. So let's reduce harms, improve transparency in the social media platforms again, and back to that point of increasing trust in institutions.
So, but what about accountability? You had actually mentioned that before. Within the institution of government or politics, where is that accountability going to come from? Because I'm looking at the Republican Party here, and they don't seem eager to hold former President Trump to account for the misinformation that he's still spreading. I mean, in 2020, as you well know, in fact, the entirety of the Republican Party's platform was basically paraphrasing whatever Donald Trump wants. So how are we going to get a system of accountability here?
Well, so we have every 2 or 4 years at the ballot box, or 6 years, depending on, you know, who your senator is. We are seeing some in the Republican Party, the Cheneys and the Kinzingers of the world, the Gonzalez, that, you know, they're few and far between, but there are others. And so I think as we get further from the 2020 election, as we get through 22, you may see more of those, but that's not good enough, right? That is absolutely not good enough. So we need the business community to step up. We need the civil society community to step up, call these people out. And we need to continue to put pressure on the platforms that give the liars and the big liars the opportunity to spew their lies. But lastly, we do have the judicial, we have the court system, right? It does take too long, but we do see lawsuits like Dominion Voting Systems against a number of these platforms. That are going to take them, and they're not going to settle. They are going to go for their $1.3 billion. Whether they win, I don't know, but that is one of the mechanisms that is available.
Okay. And we're going to come back to the platforms again in just a second, both sort of broadcast and online. But Jack, I want to bring you back in here. Do you see those pressure points that Chris Krebs is describing as an effective way to battle back against the big lie?
Well, they would be if they behaved otherwise than they are. For example, you mentioned business leaders. Well, there was just a piece in the Times a week or two ago about how right after January 6th, business after business said, oh, no, we're not giving to Republican candidates anymore. People that purvey the big lie, they're out. No more PACs for you. There was a ban. Well, this piece in the Times said business is back. The PACs are back. They smell victory for the Republicans in 2022. They could give a damn less about democracy when it comes to putting in place people who will do their bidding. That's happened. That's the business community. You were saying, well, they'll have to step up. They are stepping up. They're putting their dough behind the big lie.
Jack, I'm usually the apocalyptic one. Come on, man.
Well, do you think Jack's being sort of over emphatic here? I don't at all.
Okay. There are paths to virtue here. There are paths of recovery and restoration of the American democratic ideal. Where we're heading, unfortunately, is towards an authoritarian posture. And that's what I just find so incredibly projective and ironic about Marjorie Taylor Greene's comments the other day about calling the administration authoritarian and tyrannical. What do you call overturning an election? Seems pretty tyrannical to me. But look, again, there is no single lever to pull. There has to be leadership and people stepping up. Are we seeing enough of it? As Jack points out, no. We need more, or this thing is going to be out of our grasp before we know it.
And I suppose that's one of the points of the Aspen Institute's commission, right? To sort of gel all the areas, or attention around all the areas that need to kind of simultaneously act to push back against chaos, information chaos. But Chris Krebs and Jack Beatty, hang on here for just a second, because I want to just hear a little bit from the co-chair, from Chris's, your co-chair on the commission, Rashad Robinson, because we talked to him about another issue about why combating conspiracy theories was really important, and that was regarding racial justice in this country.
For years, Color of Change has been not only raising alarms about the power, reach, and problems of big tech and of information disorder across the media landscape, we've been working and advocating, raising the voices of our members to hold institutions accountable.
And Rashad Robinson is the president of the civil rights group Color of Change.
We recognize that we can't move forward on any of these issues without recognizing the deep and systemic ways in which information disorder impacts civil rights, impacts our progress in this country, and impacts our ability to move forward together.
And he told us more how tech companies and the spread of disinformation do have an impact on racial justice.
So let's think about COVID disinformation, information that can then be moved to communities of color because of the product design and the incentive structures at the platforms, where you could target certain communities and move lies through those communities about the vaccine or about remedies that might treat COVID and create all sorts of harm while also creating all sorts of profit.
Rashad Robinson testified before the House Energy and Commerce Committee just this week about the need for legislative action to hold tech companies accountable. So we're talking about accountability here. And he said in his testimony, quote, self-regulation for tech companies means no regulation. And no regulation means making our problems worse, not better. The more power the big tech corporations gain, the less they are regulated, the less they are liable for the harm they cause, and the less they are held accountable for the decisions they make.
You know, right now, there are major companies, Facebook, Amazon, Google, that maintain near total control over all three areas of online life: online commerce, online content, and online social connection. And they are allowed to do it because our elected officials have not created 21st century rules for 21st century problems. We have to hold our elected officials accountable. There are incentive structures that have been baked into how misinformation flows that us as individuals can absolutely do things in our day-to-day life. But at scale, this problem can only truly be solved if we create a new set of incentive structures and a new set of accountability. And that happens from our elected officials.
And Robinson says that while Congress has to act, there are other recommendations in the report that are essential to addressing the problem from the perspective of achieving racial justice, including pressuring technology companies to commit to diversity.
Companies that don't hire Black people can't be trusted to create policies to protect us. When we looked at some of the sort of policy recommendations around a reform of Section 230, we really got to removing the sort of immunities for things that were sort of related to product design, or immunities related to the sort of business model of paid advertisement. And removing those immunities deals with the fact that many of these companies believe that they can violate civil rights as it relates to advertisements around housing, credit, and data. And now we have the technology that is supposed to be taking us into the future, in fact, driving us into the past.
That was Rashad Robinson, president of Color for Change and a co-chair of the Aspen Institute's Commission on Information Disorder. He co-chaired that with Chris Krebs. Now, Chris Krebs, part of what Robinson just talked with us about has to do with the second sort of tranche of recommendations that the report has about how to build trust, which is really at the core here. It's the degradation of trust that's harming society right now. So can you just walk us through kind of briefly one or two of the other recommendations on building trust?
So one thing I think that we need to kind of keep in mind, and Rashad has made this point time and time again, is that as we were initially talking about restoring trust, rebuilding trust, Rashad made the very accurate point that there is a significant portion of the American populace that has never, in fact, trusted the government, that has never been given necessarily a reason to trust the federal government. This goes back to those the power structures that we talked about. And so one of the recommendations is making sure that we have that full accounting and understanding of American history, and that we don't forget who we are and where we come from. And the kind of the case I've made is I did not know about I never learned through grade school, and I went to pretty good schools in Atlanta. I never learned about the Tulsa race massacres back in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I saw The Watchmen on HBO that I came to understand. And that those sorts of events have happened historically. So we kind of – if we forget who we are and where we've come from, it's hard to move forward and ensure that we have the right guardrails in place to make effective policy decisions going forward. Some of the other trust recommendations are when we design social media tools, the incentive structures are different, right? Everything now is based on an ad generating model, and that is Francis Hagan and the Facebook papers has shown the algorithms are designed towards engagement. What drives engagement? The lizard brain, right? You want more dopamine and engagement, and sometimes fear and hate and rage drives those clicks. And so we need to curate more tools that are based on healthy engagement, not revenue models. And we cite some examples in there, Local Voices Networks and the Front Porch Forum. But it's not just about digital engagement. It's also platforms that encourage real world engagement. So back in our communities engagement. And that kind of is the biggest takeaway for me is the erosion of community, the sense of community that we have across America, and we've gone into these echo chambers and those kind of cylinders of danger. We've got to break those apart, and we have to come back together as the melting pot here in America. Because I still believe that we are the greatest country on earth, and we have the potential to be even greater. But kind of feels like, as we were talking about earlier and as Jack was highlighting emphatically, is that it's almost like we're walking away from that.
Chris Krebs, Jack Beattie, stand by. We'll talk a lot more about chaos and disinformation and elections when we come back. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by Wondersuite from Bluehost.com. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and get a unique WordPress website or store right away. From there, you can customize your design, colors, and content. And Bluehost automatically helps you get found in search engines like Google and Bing. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins, Bluehost makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Learn more at Bluehost.com/Wondersuite.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about why conspiracy theories, lies, and misinformation and disinformation are the biggest threats to election security in this country. And I'm joined today by Chris Krebs. He's a partner at Krebs Stamos Group. He was former head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at DHS. He served in that position between 2018 to November 2020 when he was fired by former President Donald Trump. He's now co-chair of a commission from the Aspen Institute, the Commission on Information Disorder, and they've put out a big report highlighting 15, at least 15 different ways that all of American society can work to decrease information disorder and increase trust in various institutions and systems. Jack Beattie is also joining us as well. He's On Point's news analyst. And so, Chris and Jack, here's how I'd like to sort of roll out this last segment of the show. Talk about a couple more of the solutions that the commission has recommended. And then, Chris, specifically, I do want to hear from you about lessons that you've learned from your experience from last fall and how to apply them in terms of doing anything that we can to more fully secure people's trust in the electoral system. So let's hit some of the other solutions first. First of all, you talk about in the recommendations to increase transparency about ad transparency. Can you tell us about why that got its own bullet point?
Well, stepping back a little bit, the way I see where we are with the social media platforms right now, I've likened it to kind of a post-Enron moment where we had a failure of the financial auditing and oversight system due to misreporting and lack of transparency. And how did they fix that? Sarbanes-Oxley required a set of auditing and transparency requirements for publicly traded companies. That's kind of where I see us right now in the social media ecosystem, where there's no transparency that's led to this collapse in trust in institutions and in these public harms. And so what is the equivalent of a Sarbanes-Oxley for social media platforms that doesn't necessarily say you have to allow this content but not that content? But in fact, what instead it does is say, look, you've got to let us understand how your processes work, how, you know, what your content moderation policies are, how you're enforcing them, and then opening that up to researchers and journalists in an authorized, protected way. Ad transparency is just one of those, because we are seeing, and even just yesterday, Donny O'Sullivan with CNN talked about how Facebook accepted ads for a number of Red Voices, I believe, is the company that was promoting T-shirts and other paraphernalia that promoted either, you know, anti-COVID or anti-election or whatever themes. And they're, you know, it's different when it's not political speech from political action committees, but when it's from, you know, interest groups like, you know, selling T-shirts, they doesn't have the same kind of scrutiny. So what we're trying to open up is more information about how programs and platforms are moderating their content themselves that then can lead to more informed policy choices, because we cannot make good policy decisions that would lead to actual any sort of regulation or legislation that would be have a meaningful change, because we don't have enough information, and imperfect information leads to imperfect decisions. So in part, just with the transparency piece on ads, trying to get a better sense of how these the algorithms work behind promoting content.
So that recommendation is going to meet a mountain of resistance from the social media companies, and specifically Facebook. I mean, I have it on excellent authority that when there was a discussion going on Facebook, should they even, like, you know, put a little label on who was buying the political ads that appeared on Facebook, there was concern from the very, very top of the company, aka Mark Zuckerberg, saying, well, if we do that, then we're going to have to do, you know, like, that's going to start the snowball rolling down the hill, and we're going to have to be more transparent on all our other ads. And he was worried that it would undermine the very business model that the entire company is based on. So it's going to have to come through, you know, it's going to have to overcome, not just overcome that resistance, but bulldoze the resistance. It's just going to have to come through legislation, does it not?
Absolutely. And that's, in fact, what we're recommending here is, to your earlier point, self-regulation is not an option here. Even a $5 billion consent decree against Facebook obviously hasn't changed too much in the post-Cambridge Analytica world. So we need Congress to step up. I do think that this is one of the few areas, at least in terms of broader social media platform regulation, where we have a aligned set of interests. Now, the outcomes that Republicans and Democrats want are certainly different, but there is some common space. We need to identify that. Transparency is an outcome here that I think almost everyone could agree on. Again, we're not actually talking about content moderation issues and limiting how they're doing it. It's just we want to know how they're doing it. There are no First Amendment implications here, as far as I can see it. Even the Section 230 recommendations that are more focused on paid content, advertised content, design issues. We're not saying you can't do this or government's going to regulate it. It's instead saying you don't get that immunities that Rashad was talking about. You actually may have to go to court and prove your case against a plaintiff.
Well, there's other recommendations. I want to just highlight one. We don't have to discuss it, but local media investment. I just want to trumpet that one for sure.
Yes.
But also,
so can I jump? I'm sorry.
Yeah, Megan. Yeah. No, go ahead.
Let me jump in right there. Like this is one of those tragic aspects of the current information ecosystem is that we have had this erosion and consolidation of local media where it actually just rolls up to regional and national coverage that then gets spit down to the lowest common denominator. But you look at what happened in Arizona with the Arizona Central and Arizona Mirror when they were tracking the fraud. We wouldn't have had the transparency into the process that Senator Fan and the Cyber Ninjas did if it weren't for local on-the-ground reporting in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable. And I personally paid subscriptions to Arizona-based newspapers. Now I'm sitting there like, what do I do with this? That model's not sustainable. How do we overcome that? Who's going to invest at the local level?
Yeah. Well, so you support local media, everyone. I don't say that tongue in cheek. I say that with the utmost seriousness. But in addition, there's a whole harm reduction essentially section that you have. We can't go into all of it, but in there, there's super spreader accountability. We've discussed that a little bit. You call for a public restoration fund, and also a comprehensive federal approach. So just quickly for a couple of seconds, just describe kind of what you're aiming for there.
So the comprehensive federal approach basically says, hey, government, get your act together. There is no consistent understanding of the information disorder space, whether it's a foreign threat or a domestic threat. So we need the federal government to come together, just like with any other national security threat, where they have a plan and they've tasked organizations and agencies to lay out their work streams and how they're going to approach the problem set. We don't have that. We need that. And ultimately, where I think we're going is we need to rethink the way we do government. Just like in 1939 when FDR reorganized the federal government, I think we need to rethink about how government is organized to handle technology and digital risk issues, which could result in a digital agency.
So, Jack, in hearing sort of the hopes for the recommendations that the commission has, this Aspen Institute commission has put out, does it reduce a little sense of, to borrow Krebs' word earlier, of your apocalyptic fears for the future?
Well, where there's litigation, there's hope, I suppose. Justice Holmes, I think it was Justice Holmes, said the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And yet, when you look at that First Amendment, and it allows Joe DeGeneva, for example, to say that you, Chris, should be taken out and drawn and quartered. He can say that. It allows Fox News by the hour to fill the air with lies and hateful distortions of reality. During the Civil War, Lincoln lamented when he was thinking of people were saying, oh, you can't suspend the habeas corpus. He said, so I'm to stand by while everything is being ripped up by the South, but I all the laws but one, I can't touch that one. Are we in some fundamental way as a society at the mercy of extremism because of our belief? And it may be a badly founded belief that the answer to lies and false speech is true speech.
Look, that plays into their game, frankly. The point, and Garry Kasparov has talked about this before in The Flood of Lies. This is Steve Bannon's modus operandi, the flood of, flood of lies. He uses a different word that I won't use on NPR. You can't counter asymmetric threats with facts. I think we have a set of tools and mechanisms that we haven't fully used. So just this week, a judge in Michigan directed Sidney Powell, Linwood, and others to pay sanctions to the state of Michigan and the city of Detroit. we need to use those mechanisms available to us, particularly in professional communities. So lawyers, bar associations have to hold their members accountable. We really need to up that game. Joe DeGeneva is a lawyer, and he is a member of bars, so that there's an avenue there. Doctors as well. COVID. Let's not just focus on democracy. We've got COVID. We need more medical boards to hold members accountable that push quack options here. You know, there are things that we're not doing enough of. So we need almost a great awakening in the tools that we have available. And again, this is in part what I think government can do by identifying some of the levers we have available and encouraging those communities to use them responsibly.
We've got 5 minutes left, Jack and Chris. And Chris, I really want to focus on you and your personal experience over the past 18 months, let's say. Do you still get death threats?
Death threats have dropped off. I have a certain fan base on Twitter that I wouldn't really call fans. But that's just part of the the information disorder right now. But the death threats have certainly fallen off.
Yeah, you have not been, thank goodness, quelled in your clear speech about how the dangers to our not just society but of course elections as we've been focusing on. But can you just give us a story or two of October and early November of 2020, and like when you were walking into work every day and hearing, especially after the election, Donald Trump just combating reality. Combating your work. I mean, what was that like?
So the stuff that was going on in October and early November was principally from his proxies and aides that were pushing really fantastical stories about dead Venezuelan dictators that had infiltrated algorithms that were flipping votes and things like that in systems. And those were, frankly, fairly easy to counter. Now, when the former president was amplifying those, when he's got 80 million followers or whatever it was on Twitter, and I had, you know, across me and CISA and some of the other, you know, handles we had, a combined maybe 70,000, 100,000, whatever, that's really bringing a pea shooter to a bazooka war. So that was frustrating to me, is that we had the correct information. We were not countering any individual, certainly the president directly, because that wasn't our role. But when we saw these themes emerge about machines flipping votes or Sharpies bleeding through ballots in Arizona, we went to the facts, right? We went to the state authorities in Arizona. We worked with, you mentioned at the top of the show, those 59 security experts that know how these systems work. Yeah. And that's not actually possible. And there are security controls that would catch that, including paper ballots. So we were comfortable. We had the facts on our side. But look, that's not the point. Right. It's to undermine confidence. And when it's a person of authority, certainly the leader of the free world that's pushing it, that puts you at a significant disadvantage. And that was frustrating.
You were a lifelong Republican. Are you still a Republican?
I almost liken myself to kind of post-partisan.
Okay,
You know, I've got some hope for a reemergent Republican Party on the other side of whatever the hell this is today. But there's a lot of reckoning that's got to happen. Yeah.
Now, here's what I ask, because why I ask that, because, one of the constant questions that many people have had is like, why didn't, more people within the administration or in the Republican Party speak up against the lies, against the conspiracy theories that were flowing out, after November 2020? And you're one of the people who did. And I think it's fair to say that before you did, most Americans didn't even know that there was a thing called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency.
Yes, that's right.
And I would love for you. Oh, sadly, we've only got about a minute or so left. Can you tell us the story about the moment you decided, even if it was just by that one little tweet, that you were just going to be public about your defense of the truth and the confidence that people should have in the electoral system? How'd you come to that decision? Yeah,
I came into the job in March of 2017 thinking I was just going to do basic cybersecurity work. Over the ensuing 12 months, I realized that this mission was really about defending democracy from threats, foreign and domestic. And so I spent 3.5 years prepping for a 2020 election that I knew was going to be pretty contentious. And so I was clear-eyed. I had accepted a fate that one way or the other, I was probably going to be forced out of a role, whether through a transition or I was going to be speaking truth to power. And we just did the job. And so I think others did not have that 3 years of reflection and coming to grips with decisions to be made. And so there was no friction here. There was no hesitation. We did what we needed to do in the sake of American democracy.
No epiphany, just a sense of duty for the country.
That's it.
Well, Christopher Krebs was the Director of Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security at DHS until November of 2020. He's the co-chair of an Aspen Institute Commission on Information Disorder. We have a link to that report at onpointradio.org, and he's also partner at the Krebs Stamos Group. Chris Krebs, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Jack, thank you as always.
Thank you, Magda.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.